Pack of Pushers are brought to you in part by INE, trusted training provider to the Fortune 500. Visit ine.com/packet to receive 15% off site-wide. This episode is sponsored in part by ThousandEyes, changing how you see the network. ThousandEyes shows you details of networks you don't own, such as the internet. Find out more at ThousandEyes.com/packet pushers.
This is the Packet Pushers Weekly Podcast, a deep dive on data networking, which aims to inform, amuse, advise, forewarn, forearm, caution, and counsel you on what's happening in the world of data networking. Today, we're moving into the world of the ether, that is, wireless networking. And something we haven't covered too much here on the Packet Pushers, because really that's an area where experts need to be drafted in, because it's kind of not like other networking. Normally we talk about packets, you know, going from layer 3 to 7, and wireless is much more of its focus, you know, 80% of its focus is sort of below the line, much more at layer 2 and layer 1. So to cover this gap, I've invited onto the show Raul DiNocchio. How are you, Raul? Say hi to the audience.
Hi, everyone. How's everyone doing? Thank you for having me on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. You've been running, now just quickly, you've just passed your CWNE. Why don't you tell people what a CWNE is? I'm not sure how many people know how awesome that is.
Yeah, CWNE, it's the wireless expert certification from the CWNP company. It's kind of like your Cisco certs, etc. So you have to go through your CWNA, the entry level certifications, then your professional level, and then you do the expert level.
So it's a vendor independent.
Yeah, vendor neutral is what they go for.
CCIE type thing. You've really got to work hard. It's, you know, hundreds of hours and a really hard exam.
Yeah, the CWNE is actually an application process. So you've got to write essays, have some published blog posts. There's some requirements there, but if you want to learn more, you can go to cwnp.com. Mm.
And well done on passing that, because I know there's only a few of them in the world, and the fact that it's vendor independent is what really calls it out to me. And it's something I've read the textbook on the CWND, the design one, which has been pretty helpful for me. Trying to stay in touch with wireless, which is pretty difficult. and also with us today is Francois Vergès. Welcome to the show, Francois.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And are you like Raul? Have you been heavily involved in wireless for a while?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
So I'd say Francois has been doing it longer than I have.
Okay. Fair enough. Then.
Let's say a little while longer. Yeah, I got the CWNE as well earlier. Well, I guess in 2016 now, last year. So maybe a couple of months before Raul.
Well done. Well, let's get into the topics that we want to cover today. Let's kick off we've just got a fairly general sort of an issue about things that have happened in wireless in the last couple of years. So the first one I wanted to talk about is 802.11ac. Now, this is a newish standard that's coming out from the ever slow to do anything IEEE, which sort of covers Wi-Fi and gets it up to gigabit speeds. Do you want to sort of give us a background of where that's at today?
Sure. Like today, people or vendors are coming out with 802.11ac wave 2, which is we started off with wave 1 and there was a slow rollout, and so now people are starting to hop on. Enterprises are starting to use 802.11ac, which is supposed to give us faster speeds, but we got some caveats to that because of how much frequency reuse we have available. So typically you've got vendors coming out saying, hey, you can get gigabit speeds here on wireless, which is sometimes not true because of the environment, the wireless environment, and it's a shared spectrum. So 802.11ac, just want to say that we're now into wave 2. APs are coming out, but we have the devices, like your mobile devices, your laptops, those still have to catch up so we can fully utilize the specification.
So wave 2 means what? Second gen? Is that a way of saying second generation? It's a multiple generation standard?
I'd like to say it's a marketing term.
So it's bollocks then, basically.
the biggest change in wave 2 would be multi-user MIMO. Mm-hmm. So that's the ability for the AP to send traffic to multiple stations at the same time. But, you know, multi-user MIMO as it is today has, or as it is in the standard of Wave 2, has some limitations still. and they're working on it for the next release, which we're probably going to talk about later.
So MIMO is multiple input, multiple output, which is the ability, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is the idea that an antenna, the way to increase bandwidth between a client and a server or an access point and a wireless client is to actually start transmitting on multiple antennas at the same time. So if your underlying wireless transfer speed in the case of 802.11ac is 433 megabits per second, if you could transmit it on two antennas, you could double that bandwidth, or three antennas, or four antennas. That's MIMO, right?
Well, you have the number of antennas, and you also have the number of streams, right? So you could be sending the same stream on multiple antennas, or you can be sending multiple streams. And if you want to send multiple streams, of course, you need multiple antennas.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. So if you had three antennas and you sent one stream across all three, then you could be, you know, creating what in wired terms would be called a link aggregation.
Yeah, they call it antenna diversity, meaning that the connection would be more resilient to any interference, right, because the receiver will be able to, you know, recreate the signal even if you have a little bit of interference. And that's why, you know, when they introduced Edu2.11n, they told us we're going to get better range. So that's basically why.
So that you're using two or more antennas but transmitting the same signal on all of them?
Yes, right. You can do that. But you can also, if you want to increase the data rates, you need to send multiple streams at the same time. And so, you know, the example that's often taken is that if you, instead of saying hello and then word, you're going to send hello word at the same time.
And so multi-user MIMO.
The diversity is through different antennas.
Yeah.
The multi-user MIMO is when you're using multiple antennas, but then you're able to speak to different clients. And then you could also, within the antenna that's being used with the specific client, you should be able to use one or two spatial streams. And like Francois said, that would increase your data rate. So a lot of that, we'd have to step back and really talk about single stream, because that's where wireless started. And it was one device at a time speaking with the access point. With when you start doing multi-user MIMO or just MIMO, multiple input, multiple output, you increase the spatial streams, then you start getting the higher data rate. So this is where is theoretical throughput or bandwidth is what a lot of people call it, is with these spatial streams and antennas that are available on the access point.
And so then you've got to have a client which has multiple antennas as well.
To fully take advantage of that, you do need a client with multiple antennas, or what you'll see is something like 2x2 or 3x3. So a lot of the MacBook Pros have that capability and is able to take advantage of those data rates.
If you've got a modern one, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's got to be reasonably recent to have multiple antennas and to be able to have this. And then so you have but the base stations might have four antennas even though your client's got two. So now 802.11ac allows them to be doing two antennas to my MacBook and two antennas to Ethan's MacBook at the same time.
Yes, that's the idea of multi-user MIMO.
Right. And that's sort of driving the generation. Like, I see a lot of discussion around multi-user MIMO. Is that driving vendors to release new products and customers to upgrade? Or is it just something that's going to roll out slowly over the next, you know, months ahead, years ahead?
I think it's a slow rollout just because the way enterprises work with and the budgets, they tend to slow these rollouts because of how many access points the wireless infrastructure that they have in place is typically difficult to just rip and upgrade, right? So it's going to be a slow rollout, especially if these companies are managing the devices they hand out to their users. It wouldn't make sense to fully upgrade the wireless network, but then your limiting factor is your mobile devices or your laptops.
Yeah, and I also think there's some limitation to multi-user MIMO today. You know, like when vendors, they did their test in their labs, they proved that it would increase the efficiency by 60%. But, you know, they were doing their, you know, the test in like the perfect lab conditions. So for multi-user MIMO, because you have physics involved, it's better to have your AP in the middle of the room, and then you have group of devices, you know, scattered around. And so the AP can direct basically the energy in the right direction, but more easily. And with in today's, you know, in a today environment network, wireless network, you're going to have multi-user MIMO clients, you're going to have non-multi-user MIMO clients, so you're going to have to deal with that. And
well, if a non-MIMO client's talking, then those frequencies aren't available. Do they actually, like in the case of 802.11b, you know, they stomp on all the frequencies. Once they're in there, their slow data rates actually block the duty cycle of those things. Is that the same thing with 802.11ac? If you've got legacy clients, do they slow them down?
Yeah, so the, you know, the IEEE with the 802.11 standard, they're big on backward compatibility. So everything is backward compatible. So if you have an AP that's compatible with multi-user MIMO, you can also, you know, use it. It's going to work with MIMO, normal MIMO, right? So if you have regular MIMO clients in your environment, when they're going to be communicating with the AP, they're just going to use regular MIMO. And then if you have multi-user MIMO, it's all going to, you know, work at the same time and coexist on the network. So, you know, it can create a little bit of overhead. And also, in order for multi-user MIMO to work, you have a little bit of overhead as well in order for the AP to figure out where in the space it needs to focus the energy to a specific group. And this is called sounding. Mm-hmm. And so this creates a little bit of overhead as well in order to have multi-user MIMO working. And also, multi-user MIMO as it is today in Wave 2, in 802.11 Wave 2, AC Wave 2, it only works downlink, so only for the traffic coming from the AP going to the stations. And so this is another thing, they're still working on it for the next release, which would be 802.11ax, and we're going to have multi-user MIMO in both directions, so downlink and uplink. Yeah, but right now we have some limitation, I think, and maybe that's why we don't see as much, you know, improvement on today's Wi-Fi.
Well, I'm not too sure that there's too much need for a client to upload as much as it is download. So mostly it's, you know, the asymmetry is pretty well set that you don't need to upload at gigabit. Mainly you need to download a gigabit.
Yeah, yeah, and you're going to have more download traffic, yeah.
There's also one thing to note is that 802.11b is 2.4 gigahertz only. 802.11ac right now is just only in the 5 gigahertz spectrum. So they're separate spectrums. So the 802.11b would affect anyone on the 2.4, and that would slow down their speeds. And one thing that a lot of us recommend is to turn off those 802.11b data rates, if as long as you don't have your production units on running on that on that data rate.
And, well, yeah, and of course 802.11b and most clients actually do, you know, ABG, and so if you shut off B, they still communicate anyway.
Yeah, yeah. If they're ABG or even N, you could still turn off 802.11b rates, those low data rates, and still have them operate at the higher data rates.
Mm. Yeah, don't turn everything on in your wireless. It's actually one of the lessons I learned wireless the hard way is just a lot of stuff works best if you turn down the power and turn off some of the features. But you got to know what the features are, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's a lot more to it. Lowering the power is one thing you can do because that actually limits how far the signal is going to go. But there's a lot more to it, like design and knowing what the requirements
are. Well, a lot of people just think if they, you know, they'll go and stick a Wi-Fi base station in and they'll turn it up to maximum power and that's going to make it work better. But they don't think about that the signal then might overlap with the next one along.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you actually do often get better performance in wireless if you turn down the power so that they don't interfere with each other, although that's a bit of an art form.
Yeah, there's tools to help you, you know, try to visualize that, and we call them site surveys. There's different kinds of site surveys. There's what we call predictive site survey, where you upload the floor plans to an application such as Ekahau site survey, and then you with the AP that you're going to deploy, you can simulate what the propagation would look like, and that way you can try to limit how much co-channel interference you get, which is two APs on the same channel servicing the same area. And that's where you see that's what happens when you get, say, two APs on the same channel to really close to each other, or the transmit power is really high and they can hear each other. And what you've effectively done is just created that same capacity. They're sharing the same capacity. So by adding another AP, but on the same channel, you're not really adding capacity, because any device on that channel has to share the spectrum with any other device that wants to talk on that channel.
Mm. Yeah, I've often described that as stereo in a room. If you put two stereos in different sides of the room and then turn them on with different music, you know, you can't hear anything.
Yeah, that's a very good example. In office environments, I always ask if they want to have two meetings in the same room. And that's kind of the analogy I use.
That's a good one.
Yeah, and Wi-Fi, it's like they call it the polite protocol, right? So the station, they wait for the frequency to be, you know, free in order to talk, right? So if you have, if you add an AP on the same channel, it's not, like Roald says, it's not going to add capacity, because clients are still going to wait if the frequency is busy before talking, you know, whether you have an extra AP or not.
So is 802.11ac, is that widely deployed today? Is that all the modern vendors, all the vendors that deploy, have products in this space?
Yes. It's pretty much the norm right now. AC and AC Wave 2. I think pretty much all vendors have AC Wave 2 access point. We're talking about the enterprise vendors right now. Maybe later we'll talk more about the new trend in the home Wi-Fi market.
Yeah.
But yeah, in the enterprise space, 802.11ac, it's a norm.
It's been around for a while. It's not new, I guess.
Yeah, it's not new. Yeah. You see it deployed like every network I'm working on right now. It's pretty much AC. It's been AC for maybe, you know, a year and a half, maybe 2 years. Like, it's been a while.
Yeah. So let me ask you guys a practical question. You know, if I'm an 802.11n shop, which that certainly there's a lot of N deployments done in enterprises, and I'm sitting on the fence, I'm looking at my budget, and I'm thinking, I could go 802.11ac this year. Is there a really compelling reason that I should prioritize that in my budget and make the jump?
I'd say if your work environment is working mostly on wireless, then yeah, I'd make that investment. It all comes down to what the company wants to do with wireless and how they want to manage it, and whether or not they have the environment and the devices to do this. So really gathering these requirements from how the users want to use wireless, what devices they're using, and if we're seeing that there's a lot more newer devices that are hopping onto the wireless network, then I'd say try to go ahead and really think through whether 802.11ac is the time now to jump. But really, if you're in the upgrade cycle, you're going to go to 802.11ac. You're not going to see any N products out there.
Right. You're not going to go to N, but if you're at N, you know, do you push ahead to AC? And is there a particular, like an application mix or a sort of a usage pattern or maybe client density that are strong indicators? Yeah, you're really going to see a benefit out of AC. And by benefit, I would assume that to mean, you know, better throughput, you know, less waiting to get at applications, less contention on in the air, that sort of thing.
What AC brings basically compared to N is that you have an extra modulation technique, so that would bring, you know, higher data rates. But in order to achieve this new modulation technique, which is 256 QAM, you need to be very close to the AP, right? So it's not going to apply to all the Wi-Fi clients in the network. And then the next major evolution is that you can use wider channels. So in N you can use 20 or 40 megahertz wide channels, and in AC you can you can use 80 megahertz wide channel with Wave 1. But if you design a wireless network usually for a high density, you're not going to use 80 megahertz wide channels because you need to reuse the channels more often, and you don't want to create, you know, too much interference.
80 megahertz or multiple channels like that works best for one big fat file transfer, but
yeah.
The reality of traffic is that it's multiple small transfers, like loading web pages. And
yeah,
by the time you paid the price for loading it across four channels, you might as well have just focused it across two links or one link and gotten it faster, because sometimes there's a latency delay, or you're not able to share the bandwidth with other clients. If you've got 50 users sharing the same channels, you're better off just using one channel each so that all users get a better response overall than giving one person maximum response while the other 49 wait a fraction of a second longer.
Yeah, so if you have N network that's working good and you're using 40 megahertz wide channels and you have high density, you're not going to see much more improvement going AC, because AC is pretty much, enhancement of N. Right. But if you need, higher throughput in specific locations, let's say you have a video studio and then people need to transfer, heavy files and you need the extra, the better speeds. Maybe that would be convenient to deploy AC.
If you could go and have a chat to Sony for me, I've been trying to transfer video off my camera. I'm trying to get into video lately. And I finally got the Wi-Fi working. I mean, how retarded was that? And when you started to transfer a file, the maximum transfer speed was 10 megabits per second. And I'm going oh.
It's not Sony APs, right? You're not using Sony wireless, I hope.
Well, in the camera, it actually has wireless client. And then you put a piece of software on your machine, so you go and stand in the corner and talk to a camera like an idiot, because it makes yourself feel very foolish. But then you got to get the video off the camera. Well, by the time you demount it and then carry it over to your computer and plug it in on the USB, you're like, why am I doing this again? So, but if you record something in 1080p, it's big. The files are huge. 15 minutes of video is 4 or 5 gigs, easy. Mm-hmm. And let's not talk about 5K or 120 frame per second slow-mo. Anyway, I'm just – home Wi-Fi is a whole different problem, right, of course.
But, right now in the with the enterprise gear, you can become very flexible in terms of configuration. So, and it all comes down to, Roel talked about the design and the requirements. So you need to get your requirements – down, so you know how to design the Wi-Fi. And if you have a specific area in your company where you're going to have heavy traffic, you can design the Wi-Fi differently for this area, and you can assign different configurations to different set of APs. So the Wi-Fi is going to be okay and good, performing good for these people. And then let's say you have a second section in your company. It's more like a warehouse environment. You have different clients, different speed requirements, and so on. You can also define different configuration for this set of APs. So, it allows you to be very flexible in the configuration, even on the radio side.
Before we get back to the show, Ethan is here letting you know that our sponsor, INE, has an all-access pass subscription to their extensive training library. It's $9.99 per year for every course in their collection, and that is over 330 networking-specific courses that go from automation using Python to full-blown Cisco CCIE tracks. There's over 8,500 videos in their collection. Now, INE's training style, it's for those people who like to learn by doing, so don't die by PowerPoint. Instead, watch the hands-on demonstrations that make up about 70% of INE's content that show you exactly how to do what it is that you're learning about. And by the way, there is lots to learn from trainers that are among the most knowledgeable and certified in the business. They'll teach you Wireshark, software-defined networking, and Juniper, along with, of course, the many different Cisco certifications, including the prestigious CCIE. If we go back in time to 2007, 2008, INE was one of the training providers that I used to help me pass the Cisco CCIE Routing and Switching Lab. You can learn from anywhere using your smartphone, tablet, PC, or Apple TV, and you can even rent a remote rack of equipment, gaining you access to gear that's too expensive to acquire or too difficult to virtualize. And if you're a little overwhelmed and you're just not sure what courses are the right ones for you, you can talk to an INE training advisor who will help you prepare a study path. Head over to INE.com/packet to start exploring what INE has to offer and receive 15% off your purchase site-wide. One more time, that's INE.com/packet.
What about antenna design? Last time I looked at antenna design, it was pretty straightforward. Your omnidirectional antenna, you had a couple of planar antennas, and you had some directional antennas that might cover, 90 degrees and so forth, and then point-to-point antennas. Has there been much innovation in the antenna space over the last year or two?
I'd say there's been some innovation there, where Cisco's an example. They are using dual 5 gigahertz radios, and people would call this it's hard to describe, because you can use the AP as a dual band AP where you're serving 2.4 and 5 gigahertz spectrum. But then you could also turn that 2.4 gigahertz, if you need to, into a 5 gigahertz radio. So then you could serve dual 5 gigahertz. And the reason why a lot of us focus on 5 gigahertz is because there's a lot more channels in the 5 gigahertz spectrum versus 2.4.
Like there's 11 channels in a 2.4.
Yeah, there's only three 11. Non-overlapping channels. And in 5 gigahertz, you have around 24.
Yeah, but they're non-overlapping. So it's actually not just better. It's like you get three effective channels at 2.4 and you get 24 effective channels at 5.5 gigahertz.
Yeah. And with Cisco doing that, there's a lot of complexity in that antenna design because they have to have a certain amount of separation between the radios. So when you're actually configuring a Cisco access point that has dual 5 gigahertz radios, it won't let you configure both radios within 100 megahertz of each other. So you have keep them separated so they won't interfere with each other.
Do you have to do that manually, or
All
right, yeah.
Yeah,
I think they call it software-defined radios, right?
Yeah, that's the term I was looking for.
That doesn't sound very software-defined. That just sounds like, you know, common sense. Yeah. If you do this, it won't work. So don't do this.
Marketing term.
I think they call it software-defined because in the configuration, you can choose if you want a 2.4 or 5 gigahertz radio. It's not like hard-coded in the hardware.
Yeah. It can do it automatically.
Does it have an API? If it doesn't have an API, it's not software.
Not Cisco.
No.
Some other vendors might have an API where you can kind of tie into more of the features in there. But Cisco, they have their own algorithm called RRM, Radio Resource Management, which you'll get two sides of RRM. There's people that are for it, and then there's people that hate it. But as long as you configure it outside of its defaults and tune it to your environment, it could work in your favor as long as you're monitoring what RRM is doing. Because it's not perfect. And it's going to work based on the network that you have given it. So if you gave it a crap network, it's going to operate like crap.
In terms of, to go back to the antenna question, I've seen a lot of personally when I work on typical enterprise Wi-Fi network. Usually, I either use the omnidirectional antenna, which is embedded into the AP, or I use like an external antenna of like directional, semi-directional antenna if I have like high ceilings or specific needs. But I've seen some stuff online where they're trying to create more and more antennas that blend into the environment, right? Because the aesthetic is sometimes becoming a big deal. So you could see I know this company named Ventev, they designed a few Wi-Fi antennas that blend into like an office environment. So they would put it under a carpet tile, or they would hide it on the ceiling. In the drop ceiling, and they also developed some antenna pattern for outside, for parks and stuff like this, or stadiums. So they would hide the antenna in the stadium ramp or in a park light. They're doing pretty innovating work. They even designed their own lamp design, like street lamp design. It's not a lamp, it's actually an antenna.
So it looks like a lamp. Does it have a light in it or not?
It works with a lamp.
Right. Okay.
So they try to hide it with the lamp.
So it's in the lampshade or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's actually pretty cool. Yeah. I think they talked about it this week on Twitter. Or they did a webinar or something. But I've seen it this week on Twitter. So it's getting pretty innovative, and I really liked it personally. Yeah.
I guess it's getting cheaper to make hardware. So this sort of stuff is, you know, the ability to make, you know, limited numbers of this sort of thing is. And there's also a lot more need for wireless going around. People don't want to see a plastic box stuck to the ceiling in their million-dollar reception area. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah, that's the challenge right now is aesthetics is very big. And so a company like Ventev will come out with like the antenna that goes in the floor. But then you always have to be careful with that because then somebody might just say, hey, this is a perfect place to put a metal cabinet. And so you want to be able to plan that with your building management or whoever deals with the building structure.
I saw a picture on Twitter the other day of an iPad encased in a metal cabinet. It looked lovely, and it had no signal at all. It was great.
Oh, people will ask, why doesn't this work?
Yeah. We can't beat physics, right? So we have to work with it.
Yeah, and you have to remind users about that too. So it's always this education with end users and with management about how wireless works and that it's physics. Even though you can't see it, there's some limitations there.
Thousand Eyes, our sponsor today, says that they change how you see the network. And as someone who's spent many hours with their product, that's not just a tedious marketing claim from yet another monitoring company. Rather, Thousand Eyes gives you insight into the parts of the network that you don't own, but that your critical services run across anyway. Imagine being able to monitor in detail the internet between you and your customers or between you and your SaaS providers. With Thousand Eyes, you can do exactly that. You will be able to see every individual router between you and the target you're monitoring, along with a historical view of the BGP state, alternate paths, as well as latency and loss metrics all across the internet, that network you do not own. The monitoring tests are run via Thousand Eyes cloud agents, enterprise agents that you place at useful spots in your infrastructure or on endpoints like laptops. So you can get a true end-to-end graph of a path no matter where it starts and ends, inside your network or outside of your network. You can go up the stack as well. Do things like track CDN performance, look at DDoS attack and analyze it. Check out DNS server errors. Look at issues within your ISP's network using internet outage detection, which is a really cool Thousand Eyes feature. You can measure mean opinion scores for VoIP paths and do in-depth web transaction monitoring to find out why that web server really is slow. And all these features are available through an intuitive interface that you drill into to get right to the root cause of the problem. When the root cause is spotted, you can then create a shareable report, which is really handy when you want to share what you found with that upstream third party that you might not have a business relationship with. If you are interested in Thousand Eyes, you can check them out at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers. Sign up there for a free trial and a free t-shirt.
So the next thing I wanted to talk about, what about IoT? So we're seeing the rise of things like Apple Watches. Increasingly, there's a demand in certain types of environments. Like I've seen a lot of safety gear in things like oil rigs and factories where if you fall, that there are alarmed alerting systems and they're often starting to connect to the network. So if a man goes down, so there are sensors that you clip to your belt, and if all of a sudden you stop moving and your they link them to your physical well-being. Let's just, sometimes it's as simple as if you stop moving for more than 10 minutes, it sends out an alert because it assumes that you're dead or something, or that you're unconscious. So increasingly,
that's a bad
these types
IoT
of things,
device.
Yeah. Well, I used to get, there are actually specialist analog tools for that. I did work in a beer plant once, and they had this problem where they wanted, the union was forcing the people to walk around two at a time, and it was a safety thing. So if somebody, you know, banged their head or something happened to them and they fell, you know, they got hurt, then somebody sees them. And so there was a union rule that, you know, everybody had to be visible by somebody else so they could check on each other to make sure there was no – and that's perfectly reasonable, except it costs a lot of money when you're doing a one-man job to have two people allocated to it and that sort of thing. So they started to put this gear on where it was a motion tracker, but the motion tracker was linked to an analog radio, and then the analog radio, blah, blah, blah. It was really expensive. And the thing about analog radio inside of a beer plant is that getting – line of sight radio coverage is pretty difficult. So, you know, is there, in that area, is there sort of emerging stuff for Wi-Fi to handle massive increases in number of endpoints and increasing complexity in the systems?
It's coming in there. There's a lot of different verticals that have different IoT devices. And so in my case, I work in higher education. I'm seeing all sorts of different IoT devices from wireless light bulbs to wireless paper dispensers in the restrooms to wireless sprinklers, people that are trying to gather data. And there's use cases for these things. Even wireless shower heads, for example.
Are they non-creepy use cases?
They're non-creepy. You know.
IoT
shower,
just seems creepy most of the time, right?
It seems very creepy, but really what... The shower examples, they wanted to monitor water usage. And so you want to be able to catch, for example, a leaky water head. or your sprinklers. You want to see which ones are broken or which ones aren't working or spewing out too much water. And then the case for the paper dispensers is you want to know if on a campus there's a ton of paper dispensers, you want to know which ones are out so you can just go to that one right away.
Hmm.
So there's use cases for this, except a lot of these devices use cheap hardware. So a lot of times they're going to be 2.4 gigahertz only. And then on top of that, we don't design wireless for the restrooms or for some of these areas. Hmm. So we have to change some of that as well. So that's how IoT is kind of changing the landscape for us. But they are using the 2.4 gigahertz spectrum, which a lot of people are moving out off of. And so they're putting their users on 5 gigahertz and leaving the 2.4 spectrum for all these IoT devices or anything that is 2.4 only.
Mm-hmm. I guess the other one here, of course, is the arrival of Bluetooth devices. So a couple of them, when was it? Earlier, middle of last year, we did a podcast with Aruba, and they were talking about their Bluetooth points. Then they use Bluetooth to say, what are they called?
Beacons? Bluetooth beacons?
Beacons. Beacons, yeah. That's it. Sorry. so the Bluetooth beacons tell you where you are, and they can link with an app. The app can use the beacons to say, the classic one is you're in a museum, and the beacons say you're now standing in front of this picture, and then your app goes, oh, you're standing in front of the picture of the Mona Lisa, and then it starts telling you all about it in your headphones, that sort of thing. So instead of handing out, you know, custom pieces of hardware that you can listen to, you can just start using an app on your iPhone, on your favorite smartphone, and walk around the museum. But Bluetooth is a 2.4 gig spectrum, and mm-hmm. then the beacons are then, some of them are actually becoming active. They're not just passive, they're actually active, connecting back to the Wi-Fi so that they can be monitored, managed. Have you done much of that?
I'm barely getting into that space because mm-hmm. there are some use cases where people, for on campus, students are trying to find empty rooms or desks. And so instead of wasting precious time walking and trying to find one, some people are developing applications where once you walk into the building and you have the app, you can easily identify, okay, there's an open desk in this area. Can you tell me how to get there? Because I've never been to this building. Show me how to get there. And so it's going to use the blue dot navigation on how to get to a room that's not occupied, for example. Mm. So that's one way that's being used. And then some people try to drive that through analytics to see where people are congregating and then kind of tie that into some application that, like safety, for example, is one where you could shoot a message to everyone. But of course, they have to have the app.
I wouldn't use the word shoot a message because you could also use it to track protesters and send in someone else, something else. Maybe you could send a message and let politics do the shooting, maybe.
That's a better way to put it.
Yeah, I'm very sensitive.
Have you worked with anything, Francois, with the Bluetooth?
No, I haven't used the BLE beacons yet. But I would love to you know, work with them one day. It looks pretty good.
Yeah, well, I've seen some of the demos around the retail applications too, where they're using it to do footfall tracking, like where people walk in their stores and how many. And in some cases, they also want to be able to track people by name as they move through their stores.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it becomes creepy a little bit for the users sometimes. Yeah, you have to set borders, right?
Yeah, I think that this idea of logging into the local Wi-Fi with your Facebook or your Twitter, and at the same time you give away your rights, like you've agreed to be tracked by username as you walk through the store, and then forever after they've got access to your Facebook account or something. That just seems a bit, that seems open to abuse and negative outcomes. But
yeah,
hey,
I agree.
I remember when I was testing it, I was testing this social media logging feature. In my house, and my house was just being built, and then the house next to mine was also being built, so workers would come during the day. And I just set it up to, open network, and so I could see the workers logging into my Wi-Fi, and I could see their Facebook information and everything, right? So people, they don't care, they just want to get access to internet, right? Whether it is, they're going to give their email or Facebook information or whatever.
Yeah, it's either they don't care or they're ignorant.
Yeah.
But the companies that in retail space, for example, they're giving free Wi-Fi. So they feel that we're offering you a free service. We are going to try to make this experience better. And I'm using air quotes here, better user experience, because then they'll try to put specific advertisements in front of you. So you walked in front of a shoe and there's a TV screen there. Maybe they'll flash that shoe on the TV screen and show somebody that's walking with the shoe, and you're like, yeah, that could be me. That's an example of how some of these retail spaces are using it.
Great. They're trying to find a reason to invest in the technology, right? So I think that's why. It's like a business. They need to see a business case for, purchasing the Wi-Fi, the BLE, and then offering it to the clients. When they present a solution to management, that's how I see it. So,
yeah. It does open up a bag of worms, bag of trouble, world of hurt, whatever metaphor you want to use for that, because I think it's going to get worse. Like, wearables and is going to be much more, not only do you have your smartphone, but increasingly people will have devices with data on them, like smartphones that's accessing your personal health. Or what if you have a medical pump of some sort, maybe an insulin pump or something more medically significant, and if that starts shedding data onto the wireless network, there's a whole bunch of issues there that I don't think anybody's thought about.
I agree. Anything with IoT, wearables, they tend to have very poor security. So you're putting a bunch of insecure devices on your wireless network. And with wireless, you can sniff those frames wirelessly. You don't need to be on the network to see those frames. So you can sniff them and identify what devices are using wireless, for example. And if they're using weak security, like a pre-shared key, if you capture enough frames, there's applications out there that'll hack those frames and kind of put together, hack the algorithm of the security, and then say, hey, here's the pre-shared key that I created from these frames you captured, and then people hop on the network. And usually that's what those IoT devices need, is a pre-shared key, because they don't do anything like 802.1x, for example.
I was actually asked this question by somebody this week, saying a professor wants to ask, how would you fix the lack of security on WLANs? And I wrote down spectrum integrity, like how do you... You've got to maintain the integrity of the actual radio, because the signaling is the layer one. If the layer one is jammed, then your Wi-Fi doesn't work, right? So how do you protect your spectrum? So let's just assume that that's kind of, there's not a lot you can do about that.
There's nothing much you can do about radio frequency, because someone can jam it. I've seen even a device kind of go haywire and start spewing all sorts of RF, and that kind of jammed the network. The least I'll say is I like to prefer people to use 802.1x, but then there's a caveat, because then you need the expertise for 802.1x, and then you need the infrastructure for it. So a lot of these companies don't have that in place. They don't have the funds to have someone full-time and manage that. And I don't know, Francois, I don't know what you've dealt with security on your end, but in higher education, we tend to use open networks and 802.1x on a different SSID.
Yeah, and to try to answer Greg's question, in order to protect the spectrum, what we can do on the enterprise side is use what they call a wireless intrusion prevention system. So basically, it's going to be devices that are going to listen to the spectrum and try to see if you have any unusual activity, and then they're going to report it to a server or a backend, and then the admin, the network engineer, whoever is taking care of the Wi-Fi, can try to see what the problem is and try to mitigate it.
IPS will give you information about the spectrum, in the same way that if you're doing very, very high security networks, and if somebody taps into your copper, you'll see signal strength drop, and that's a sign that somebody's tapping your cables. Wireless IPS gives you roughly the same thing for the spectrum, but it does require a lot of management. You have to have these nodes around that are allocated to wireless IPS, or you need access points which include the IPS functions in every access point, and that has an extra cost associated.
Yes, because so you could use your access points to do the IPS feature, like you said, but when they listen to the spectrum, they have to go offline, off channel. They call it off channel, and so they don't provide any connectivity to any access to any clients when they do that, right? So, so like you said, there's a little cost to it. And plus, it requires a lot of management. And because Wi-Fi is physical, basically, so if you have an issue, you can have to go on site and see what's up, you know? So it adds a lot of work management to it.
And there's some vendors that are coming out with APs that have a dedicated radio just for security. So always scanning the spectrum, always scanning for IPS. But I know Motorola it's going to cost more.
Like this. Yeah. A tree, they call it a tree radio APs. Mm-hmm. The next door radio for the just to the scanning purposes. Yeah.
Well, the cost of hardware has dropped a lot. I can't remember. It's been a while since I've been deep into Wi-Fi, but a lot of them are saying they can put the chipsets that go in there now are sufficiently programmable that you can actually just put everything on the board, but not necessarily enable it all. It just becomes a software license.
Right. Our industry is moving to that route, unfortunately.
Well, you don't want to keep replacing the hardware because the hardware is kind of not the point. The point is to be connected. And so every time you want to do something, you don't want to have to keep replacing the boxes because that's pretty pricey. But if the features are there and it doesn't cost any more to the client at buy time, and then they can enable them later when they've got pain, then that's the best way to sell a pain relief technology, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but at the same time, Wi-Fi is evolving, you know, very fast, and you have a new standard coming out every so and then. And so when the new standard comes out, you still have to change your equipment, right? So
Yeah.
I guess it would work for the same standard. Like you said, you could enable features and you could make your customer pay more to get more features.
Well, you know, increasingly what we're seeing is that the cost of the silicon and the cost of the box itself is not significant. Like to add some features to it and just not use them is actually sort of normal behavior. And you can enable licenses. So there's quite a few switches in the Cisco Nexus lineup now that have features in them but are only enabled when you buy licenses for them, like layer 3 routing. The hardware exists, but until you buy a license and software enable it, there's quite a few switches that don't actually do layer 3 routing sort of thing.
Don't give the vendors any ideas, Greg.
Well, we can talk about commoditization. That'd be an interesting one. We're seeing the rise of white box in wired networking. That is this idea that there's a generic Ethernet switch that works for a large number of use cases. And the idea of buying highly customized, products and from our normal suppliers, from whoever it might be, Cisco, Brocade or whatever, Brocade Ruckus, et cetera, just doesn't make sense. Why don't we just buy a generic chassis and then run a piece of software on top of it and move forward from there? Is there anything happening in that space for Wi-Fi, or are they still pursuing the custom hardware front? Well,
Greg, supposedly Open Compute Project is going to get into that space. Now, I haven't heard any specific developments, but last time we talked to those folks, they said that that was coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's still in the early development phases, because I remember seeing that a couple months back, but I don't think I've heard anything new. And I think the differentiation factor here is a lot of vendors have their own proprietary type features and the different ways they talk to their access points. So hopefully we'll make that jump. But yeah, I think it's going to go that route where we'll see white box APs, and it'll be easy to... Maybe you might not be happy with vendor A and you want to go to vendor B, but you don't have to replace all your APs, for example. Just load software on there. I think it'll go that route, but just not soon.
Like right now, we see more and more vendors having the controller-less solutions or the management features in the cloud. Mm. So maybe in the future, we can imagine having all the managing features included into like a SDN or something. And so you would just have APs installed physically, so and then you'd have like the SDN managing everything.
Sorry, go ahead, Francois.
No, that's how I see it. Maybe in the future, the next few years, with the SDN and everything happening on the wired side, I wouldn't be surprised if all the controller's features would be, outsourced to the SDN.
I would say, for the devices we can put firmware on, one vendor or company you guys want to look at is Cucumber Wi-Fi, and you can go to cucumberwifi.io, and they'll list devices in which you can install their firmware on and then be able to manage your Wi-Fi there. I would say that's the only vendor I've known that's been doing this. There's probably others out there, but I think Cucumber Wi-Fi has been very, you know, presented to everybody in Wi-Fi space. A lot of people know these guys.
Okay, because I know that merchant silicon is pretty standard in the Wi-Fi industry. That is the Wi-Fi chipsets that most vendors use are actually standardized. Where they actually apply their mystical sauce is in the antennas and the software. Is that like they all used to use the same chipsets?
I get mixed results because they all say, yeah, we all use merchant silicon, and then each AP performs differently. So it really then comes down to the design of the AP, the antennas. Mm. But then, yeah, the magic is really in the software and what you could do with it, because some management, cloud management software is not very good. Some are lagging behind. But the great thing is you can get a demo from a lot of these vendors and then get a feel for how it is, and then go with the one that you're most comfortable with and one that works with your environment.
Coming back to the issue of security, what about things like network integrity? So one of the areas where I was thinking about is it possible to come into a wireless network and just start adding devices to it? Or is there some sort of security control so that if I bring up another base station, it just doesn't join the network?
You want to take that one, Francois?
Well, you're talking about like an open Wi-Fi network, or you're talking about a Wi-Fi that's secured
A bit of both. I mean, the thing is that it's, you know, what is it that keeps the integrity of that part of the network working?
Well, if you need to authenticate yourself, or if you need to authenticate the device, you know, the device is not going to associate to the Wi-Fi if you're not authenticated, right? But if you have an open Wi-Fi and then, a captive portal or this type of solutions, what you could do, you could limit the number of association in the configurations. So you could say, okay, for this AP, I limit it to 40 associations, or, 60, 80, 100, whatever you think is appropriate for your design.
And when you're talking about the base stations, the access points, I think that is a problem with a lot of companies, and that's where the intrusion prevention IPS comes in. And so you would be able to have a report that says, I see this many rogue APs, and these are the APs I see this rogue at. And then someone would have to go out there and find that rogue. Or on the wired side, if you have a way to only authenticated devices hit the wired side, block it off at that port, for example. In my experience with the in a campus environment, we don't have that too much restriction on that because of the teaching and learning. Some of the students are in electrical engineering, so they may be putting in, an access point and try to do something. But we generally use some of the built-in reporting in our systems to see, hey, we're seeing this rogue. It's broadcasting our SSID, but it's not a AP that's in our system, for example. Right. But even then, some of those IPSs or security systems aren't very robust or very developed. And so you'll get mixed responses on which security platform to go with, for example.
So that's sort of a solved problem. Like, I can't just come along and bring a Wi-Fi in and have a device. You know, the device has to be sanctioned to be a part of the network.
Right, yeah.
Right. What about mesh networks? So we've seen, I remember a couple of years ago, we had a lot of push around mesh networks. And the idea was with mesh networking is that instead of connecting them together with cables, you just put a bunch of Wi-Fis to the roof and they'll transport. They might talk to clients on one frequency, but then they'd connect data back to a central point over wireless. Is that still popular, or have we pretty much given up on that? I seem to have a sense it's over.
Actually, no. It's you know all the new home Wi-Fi solutions that are coming out there, like Eero, Google Wi-Fi Portal, all these new solutions that actually use mesh.
Yeah.
So to interconnect all those little boxes, so instead of running cables through your house, you can just use the Wi-Fi to backhaul the connection to the
internet. Those are really home solutions, though. In the enterprise, is anybody going the mesh route?
In the enterprise, or where I use mesh, is more for outdoors solutions where you cannot run a cable, and it's more convenient to just use a mesh. So yeah, I've used it in outer space, like, you know, city parks and environment like this. I don't think I've used it indoor.
Yeah, there's not going to be a lot of use cases to use it indoor because of the limitations of using mesh. The biggest one is you'll lose throughput when you use mesh. And sometimes mesh is a solution where you can't get cabling in there, but there's people there that need Wi-Fi. And then there's some very special use cases where if you want to provide Wi-Fi in a parking garage, for example, because someone's just walking from their car to wherever they're going, and then you could use mesh rather than running cabling everywhere in a parking garage. And then there's somebody I know that I'll try to find a link to this paper, but he did mesh for miners. So I don't know all the details, but all I know is he put Wi-Fi really down below in the earth for miners, and they're able to get it going with mesh, which was pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, that's cool.
That's pretty secure too. Like, he's got control of the spectrum down there.
No neighbors, hopefully.
So the Roel said one of the limitations of mesh is that it reduces the bandwidth because, you know, the channel is used twice, once to transfer data to the client and then once to backhaul the traffic to the root AP, what they call the root AP, the one that's wired in. And so what vendors are in the home space, some vendors like I think Netgear or Lixis, they're developing a three radio access point where they would have one radio dedicated for the backhaul connection. And this way you don't lose any throughput, basically. So they're adding a Wi-Fi radio that would replace the cable, basically, and just to go over the, you know, limitation of mesh.
Mm.
So we might see this more and more in houses.
Yeah, okay, yeah, because it's cheaper to, if you want bandwidth inside, you can't really, if you're doing indoor, you need high density, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So it makes more sense, and that means high bandwidth in the backhaul, makes more sense to run a cable, since running cable inside a building is easy, and you also need to power the access points anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
Whereas outdoor, you've often got power, say, in a light fitting, or, you know, in a garage, there's power sockets around the garage usually, or it's not hard to run power in a garage because you just tack it to the wall. Mm-hmm. You don't have to rip up the floor or tear down the plasterboard. So it makes different sense in different places. So it just knowing, I think in my head that, you know, outdoors kind of makes sense for mesh and indoors mesh doesn't, is kind of an interesting idea. Probably makes sense overall.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mm. Software-defined networking is taking over just about every other part of physical networking. We've seen it arise in the WAN and we've seen it obviously in the data center. Is there a push for software defined to hit the wireless networking? I mean, in a certain sense, I always regarded wireless controllers as sort of like being the first controller, you know, software defined controllers in a way, although that wasn't what they were trying to do. They were actually trying to act as configuration engines for wildly disparate network. But, you know, is there a push to do, you talked earlier about being in the cloud, is that just becoming like the default to just manage Wi-Fis from the cloud, or are we still seeing on-site management platforms as well as wireless controllers, or are controllers going away, like wireless controllers as opposed to SDN controllers? How's that work?
I'll admit that I've been hiding under a rock in terms of SDN. So I don't know, is SDN the cloud? But but yeah, I would say controllers are trying to automate a lot of configuration. One solution is like RRM, for example. They're automating and taking in data from APs and saying, okay, this AP is seeing a lot of interference on channel 1. Let me automatically change that to channel 6, for example. I don't know if that gets that close to SDN, but then to touch upon the cloud controllers, that's, I think, just getting rid of a physical controller in the office and then not having to upgrade that big physical controller all the time and just manage all your APs in the cloud, such as using Meraki. And then that way you've got people who are constantly updating the management side. So you're getting all these features and you're not having to rip and replace APs and controllers all the time just because you want that one specific feature or two specific features. That's where I see the advantage of going to cloud for your management of your APs.
Yeah, I haven't worked a lot with SDN either, but how I see it is maybe, you know, all the radio features and configuration, maybe it's still going to stay at the access level, access point level. So maybe they're going to talk with each other and then try to figure out the best channel and, you know, all the Wi-Fi, you know, radio stuff, the RF stuff. And then after that, you know, all the network configuration like VLAN, SSIDs, you know, all this stuff, maybe they could be included into SDN. And then, you know, take advantage of all the new SDN features and programming and everything. Maybe that's where it's going and it could be possible.
So where does it go from here? What's coming next for Wi-Fi? Is there some sort of hot, I mean, aside from the fact that the IEEE takes forever to get things done. you know, every vendor's, all of the vendors of the chipsets and the Wi-Fi, you know, the wireless companies are all trying to get their patents into the technology so that they can get royalties, that's a big part of why it takes so long. There is a straight out engineering problem, right? So making this stuff work isn't particularly easy, but what doesn't help is that they've all got patents and they're all investing in patents and then try to make money out of them by getting them into an IEEE standard.
Yeah, so right now they're working on the 802.11ax standard. Mm. So it's also known as the high efficiency wireless, and it's going to be an improvement of the, you know, the current 802.11ac standard. But they want to achieve better speeds, and in particular in high density environment. Right, so they're announcing 4x speeds compared to what we have this AC. They released the first draft, I think, late last year, but they received a lot of comments, I think, over 7,000 comments on it. So they're working on the second version right now, and then they're not planning on releasing the second version of the draft before the end of this year.
Mm.
So maybe vendors are going to try to come out with some AX-compatible access point, just, you know, or I guess more to test the draft. But I don't see, you know, any AX equipment coming out anytime soon anyway.
Is there much demand from customers or is it just a small market?
I haven't seen much demand from anyone wanting 802.11ax. I think people, it's still new, so I don't think a lot of people know about it, especially on the consumer side, your end users. Mm-hmm. And there really aren't any devices that are 802.11ax yet. So we haven't heard of anyone saying, hey, how come I'm not hitting 10 gigabits per second.
Yeah. And I think once you sort of get to a gigabit, a lot of the passion for it just goes away because that's enough bandwidth for now. And even for the next few years, I can't see having gigabit to the client being more than enough. Now, sure, in Wi-Fi, once you get more than 5 meters away from the base station, it drops off to half and blah, blah, blah. But even then, most people are still pretty happy to get 3 or 4 megabits per second, right?
And yeah,
yes,
that's usually sufficient enough. I'd say even 5 if they're wanting to do video like Netflix or for example. But yeah, it really just comes down to the environment, because a lot of the environments now are considered high density, and so we have to divvy up that data rate for all the clients. And so a stadium, for example, you're rarely going to see anything over probably 2 megabits per second, because of just how many devices there are, how many people are trying to access the network and upload, you know, a photo to Instagram or Facebook and saying, hey, I'm here at the game, for example. Or even video recordings that people are trying to upload. And then stadiums are using special apps to engage with their customers, the viewers, and they have video as well. So it's, when it comes down to it, you're probably going to see in a high density environment, not really fast speeds, just because it's going to be shared amongst a lot of devices.
I get the sense, and I'd be interested in your point of view because you know more about than me, is that really the next generation of Wi-Fi isn't about faster, it's about more endpoints in the same spectrum.
And that's what 802.11ax is going to try to solve. It's going to try to make the RF more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and it gets really technical, and I have to read the documents multiple times to understand, because it's getting really complex.
Those documents are like 500 pages, and they're about as boring as banging your head on. Oh my god!
It's a good way to go to sleep at night. Just pull up a standard and start reading the first paragraph, and you're done.
Because the first paragraph refers to so many other paragraphs, right?
Pursuant to paragraph 10, subsection A.
Yep, that's how I start my evenings.
What, writing that sort of stuff?
Reading. But yeah, 802.11ax is supposed to help with high density environments, and it's supposed to help make the RF more efficient. But with that, it's very complex now, and it's hard to even understand. And you got to track back and see, how did wireless start, and then how did we get here?
Yeah. I feel bad for people just starting in Wi-Fi. They're going to have to study, you know, everything from B. And then when they think they're done, AX is going to come out, and they'll be like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing. I mean, I remember thinking a couple of years ago, it's like MPLS. How hard would it be to get into MPLS today? And then you realize actually MPLS doesn't have much meaning going forward, because software-defined software, you know, control of these devices is going to take away a lot of the pain associated with the underlying. Someone's going to need to know about it, but it's only going to be a very small number of people who are going to be, whereas today anybody who's operating Wi-Fi needs to know everything. And tomorrow it'll just be, if I click this, that'll happen. And you call for an expert when you run out of pain, when you run into a problem.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and I would say that when you're dealing with Wi-Fi, you also have to know how the network works, because most of the time people are going to tell you Wi-Fi is down, Wi-Fi is not working, I can't get online.
The internet connection or the firewall or the WAN accelerator or the...
Yeah,
it could be like, you know, a DNS issue, DHCP,
could be
anything, right?
Yeah.
So for anyone getting started...
You have to know the other pieces.
Yeah, I say anyone getting started, know networking first and then get into Wi-Fi.
And if I was talking to people who are getting into networking, I'd say no servers and desktops first.
And if I was,
because that's very
well in the Wi-Fi space, I found that you have two type of people. You have people coming from the networking side, and you have people coming from the radio side, right? And I think it's harder for the people coming from the radio side, because they have to learn about a whole bunch of networking stuff that they're not comfortable sometimes with.
Yes.
I think it's easier for someone coming from the network side, and they study the radio side, and then they, you know, it's more like an extra piece added to the network, basically.
I've just thought of something. What about clients? So a lot of the time, wireless used to have lots and lots of problems with drivers. So, you know, Windows drivers for wireless hardware used to be really problematic. Has that been solved much lately? Is that getting better?
Nope.
Yeah. Because there's a common say that says that 80% of Wi-Fi problems are clients' issues. So I'll say it's if it's really a Wi-Fi issue, you know, when you narrow it down to it's not the DHCP, it's not DNS, it's not, you know, routing or anything, it's Wi-Fi. Most of the issues, it's usually related to the client.
Yeah, I almost resort to just troubleshooting the client first. If I do my quick checks and know that wireless is good, got to be the client. And I've run into many issues where the client just start going crazy and just wouldn't connect, or there was a specific setting within the driver that you needed to change because for some reason someone said, I only want to use 802.11g, and they won't be able to connect to 5 gigahertz. And at least there's flexibility in these drivers, but then with that flexibility comes more complexity within the driver, and then you have issues and people don't update those drivers often. That's another problem. But yeah, typically we run into client issues a lot.
Yeah. I think there've been improvement though, because I've talked to some engineers that worked on the all wireless space where you don't have any wired connection. All the, you know, employees are using Wi-Fi to connect, and he had a whole bunch of issues, and he talked to, you know, he talked to the people that developed the drivers to make it better, and I think it helped a little bit for, you know, on the driver side, but we still have issues anyway.
Well, I think we've probably just about talked through all of the issues that I had on my agenda. Is there anything else you wanted to cover today?
I just want to say, for anyone who's getting started in Wi-Fi, and if you've got your networking background, et cetera, but just want to take a look. If you go to cwnp.com, they'll list out the different wireless certifications, but even if you just get the books and start reading, or even reading the 802.11 standards, that's a great way to get started. And you can even get started using your consumer home wireless access point and start really understanding how Wi-Fi works. And you could use that with Wireshark, for example, to capture wireless frames, and then you could really tie the frames down to the standard and understand how communication works. That's, I think, the best way to get started for wireless rather than starting off on a vendor.
There's a good point there in that CWNE is a vendor-independent education system. And I have found that to be just outstanding way. Like, their textbooks are great reading. And I just I had to do some wireless stuff about 18 months ago, and I got the CWND book out and went through it again to remind myself of all the issues. Mm-hmm. And because it's vendor-independent, you'll be better equipped to understand the wireless networking than if you buy a single vendor's training. I found that to be very limiting over the years. You get that vendor's perspective, which isn't necessarily a long-term success strategy, shall we say.
Yeah, and you might be turning knobs and you won't know what the knob really does.
Yeah.
And vendor neutral doesn't mean they don't talk about vendors at all. They talk about the different vendors and what their technologies are. Mm. But, you know, they explain that it's a proprietary protocol and everything. So, yeah, I like that about them as well.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for joining us on the show today. First of all, let's say thanks to Francois Verges. Do you want to tell people where they can find you on the internet, Francois?
Yes, they can find me on Twitter at Verges Francois. So it's my last name, my first name. Mm-hmm. And I also run a blog, Symphio Networks/blog. And also people can listen to the Clear to Send podcast and hear me sometimes.
Fantastic. And Raoul?
Sure. You guys can find me on my blog, packet6.com/blog. And I'm also on Twitter at Raoul Dionisio. And then Francois and I got together and created 5 Wi-Fi tips that people can implement today. And when this episode goes live, you can go to cleartosend.net/packetpushers, and we'll have that in a blog post and a PDF format for you guys to take.
Cool. And that is, part of the reason that the guys are on the show is the fact that they have the Clear to Send podcast, which is a wireless-centric podcast. So if you want to know more about it, go and listen to it. They've got about 50 episodes out the door, which means it's probably gotten through the pain threshold of the early days. Well done, guys. That's pretty amazing. and that's a big reason why I got them on the show, is because I wanted to let you know that there's another networking podcast out there focused on wireless. Go over to clear2send.net and say hi, and you can subscribe and find out more about their podcast. As always, this has been The Packet Pushers, and thanks for listening to us. Tell your friends, rate us on iTunes, and spread the love. We really appreciate it. If you've got any questions or comments about the show, or in fact anything, just send us an email to packetpushers@gmail.com. Head on over to our website at packetpushers.net. We've got a range of fine social media tools which you can join: Facebook, Twitter, etc., and all that's on the website as well. Thanks again for listening to us. We really appreciate your time, and remember that too much technology would never be enough.